Welcome to Dorm Grade Chili for the College Student Soul. This is Carol Spindell from the Department of English. The 13 short podcasts you are about to hear were written in a nonfiction writing class I taught the fall semester of 2009 in the Campus Honors Program. The stories capture the quirky realities of campus life. Each story is read by its author. Dorm Grade Chili for the College Student Soul. We hope you enjoy listening.
No Place Like Home by Gwendolyn Wydra.
Confused, I compared the two keys in my hands. Yes, I was using the right one, the closet key rather than the door key. I compared the two beds smashed into the tiny room. Yes, I was standing next to the bed that was not lofted, which my roommate and I had decided would be mine. Why, then, couldn't I get the adjacent closet open? The dull silver lock taunted me from its place on the smooth amber door. I was in the middle of trying to will it open when my roommate came in. "Can you get your closet open? I don't think my key works," I said as she carried in boxes filled with novels about dragons and pictures of her and her boyfriend at the Renaissance Fair. "That's my closet," she told me. "The key they gave me opens that one." "Oh," I said, relieved that the door was locked for some reason other than my own personal failings. "I guess they gave us the wrong keys. Let's switch." "No." I stared blankly at her. "Why not?" "I already put my stuff in there." She moved to what should have been my closet and opened it, revealing a winter coat and a vacuum. "I don't feel like moving all that again." "Are we looking at the same closet?" I wondered. "Is some of her stuff invisible?" "It's not that much stuff," I said hesitantly. She sighed, annoyed. "Gwen, I'm tired, and I don't want to deal with this right now," she said, locking the closet. Though I was frustrated, I decided this wasn't the end of the world, so I would have to walk diagonally across the room to the closet next to her desk instead of the one next to my desk. So what? Besides, I told myself, you still have all the space under your bed. Inside underbed drawer number one, though, were piles of tapered leg jeans and kitten-adorned t-shirts that I was pretty sure weren't mine. Panicking, I went to the second drawer, in which I was horrified to find my roommate's original handwritten manuscript of her story about people who morphed into cats and fought dragons. I swiveled on my heels and saw that the space under the lofted bed was equally full, packed with plastic boxes in which I could just make out some socks, also decorated with cats. "You can't take the drawers under my bed and the space under your loft," I cried. With a hint of an attitude, she replied, "Sorry, but where was I supposed to put my pants?" I felt my eyes widen in disbelief. In the closet across from your bed. Too much work. Dazed, I unlocked the closet she had assigned to me, only to find myself unable to open it all the way. There, at the base of the door, were dark green curly-toed elf shoes. Mold-colored laces snaked from a mossy green cave onto a bed of suede grass covering the shoe's surface. Like a tree's gnarled root erupting from a flower bed, the emerald footwear rose from the carpet and slowed my unpacking yet again. I turned again to face my roommate, who, to my horror, was throwing all of my things, including my sneakers, their soles caked with mud and dust and sweat from the dorm staircase, onto my freshly made bed. "What are you doing?" I asked in bewilderment. "I need to vacuum, and your stuff's in the way," she said without looking at me. At a total loss for words, I stood with my fists clenched outside my second-choice closet that wouldn't open, and stared at my boxes of clothes with no place to go, blocked by the green roadblocks at my feet. I glared at her as she arranged my shoes on my pillow, and, in a sudden moment of defiance, pelted her ugly green shoes onto the lofted bed. She looked at me angrily. "Don't touch my stuff." I just stared at her. "I needed to get into my closet, and your shoes are in my way."
Quad Day by K. George.
Quad Day. As a freshman, this day can be completely overwhelming. It is the day in which the university's myriad student organizations set up booths on the quad in an attempt to show off what they do and to recruit new members. My freshman year, I had no idea what to expect. After wandering around for over an hour, I had accumulated a bag full of giveaways, everything from pens to magnets to t-shirts. In my friend's attempt to collect every free item, she had signed me up for a variety of organizations. I still get emails from the Knitting Illini and the Harry Potter fan club. But even after all that walking, I hadn't found anything that truly interested me, until I heard a girl, draped in colorful scarves and wearing dangly earrings that reminded me strongly of the gypsy women I'd seen in Spain, yell, "Are you interested in volunteering abroad?" "Well, I've never really thought about it before, but yeah, I guess," I replied, reluctantly adding another flyer to my stack. She beamed back at me, offering up a thin woven bracelet from a pile she explained proudly had come from the children she'd worked with in Ecuador. I have to say that I was impressed that kids my age were willing to spend their time fundraising and organizing volunteer trips without any outside assistance, that they were willing to forego a well-deserved winter break with friends and family, and even cherished New Year's festivities, dedicating their time instead to people who, in the beginning anyway, were total strangers. In high school, I wasn't exactly a joiner. In fact, I hadn't been in any club for more than a year. But as she described the application and interview process for trip participants, I found myself hoping they would accept me, and eager to prove what I could contribute to the organization. Little did I know that less than 2 years later, I would be an executive member of this service organization, International Impact. Last week, I was the one sitting at the booth on Quad Day, recruiting new members, regaling them with stories from my unforgettable trips to Peru and Guatemala, eagerly pointing out posters on the board of my group teaching English in the town's biblioteca, or of another group helping save turtles in Costa Rica. Truthfully, I tell them, I probably would never have known of this organization's existence if it hadn't been for Quad Day. So even though it's hot, it's crowded, and you may find most of the booths on Quad Day either lame or outright bizarre, it's worth exploring. Students show up to work on Quad Day because they're passionate about their organization, and they hope that you will discover a similar passion for their organization or any other. All you have to do is get out there, get involved, and find out what really matters to you.
At Least the Benefits Are Good, by Lauren Anderson.
I was raised on a strict diet of hard work and diligence. No success was easy, no windfall came free. Naturally, I grew up believing that hard work was the way of the world and all its inhabitants. Cut to my first day on the job as a secretarial assistant at the University of Illinois. I approached the door of my new office 10 minutes early, with visions of dancing file cabinets just on the other side, ready for me to tackle. However, as I pulled the door handle, the images of the parading cabinets vanished. The door was locked. 5, 10, 15, and 20 minutes passed by as I waited outside the locked door. 10 minutes after my scheduled arrival time, the door slowly slid open, and my boss appeared. If it's true that people often look like their pets, then my boss must own several parakeets. Slight, with a bright yellow ensemble and teased hair erupting from a single point atop her head, she flitted about the office absent-mindedly. After my first 2 hours of work, I used the term sarcastically, I remained unclear of the details of my position. In those 2 hours, I had, however, acquired enough knowledge of the office politics to make me mistrust every other employee in the building. Before I could dwell too fervidly on the audacity of the latest water cooler scandal, though, my parakeet supervisor introduced me to my first major project. Since my references had reported to her that I am a hard worker, she told me that she expected I could complete the project in about a week. 5, 10, 15, and 20 minutes passed by in the file room. I had completed my first project, double-checked my work, and watched the second hand rotate the clock for 2 minutes. Refusing to sit idly any longer, I reported to my boss, hoping for reassignment to my next task. Instead, the bright parakeet molted into a searing hawk. Her beak snapped at me. "If you finish your work this quickly, the rest of the department looks lazy." A single talon pointed menacingly toward me, still red and lacquered. "Do you want to make the department look lazy?" Her cashmere wingspan shadowed the wall behind her. I heard the two campus bell towers strike noon, slightly out of sync with one another. My bright parakeet reappeared before me, the hawk's black eyes morphing into nothing but dark mascara by the time the 12th bell count struck. "It's time for my lunch break. See you tomorrow," she tweeted.
What's My Name Again? By Rosie Yang.
I was born Yang Ruoxi, hailing from the city of Nanjing in the Jiangsu province of China. The Yang stood for my family, the Ruo for strength and perseverance, and Xi for hope. For the next 5 years, 4 months, and 22 days, I was content and couldn't imagine a different name for myself. That complacency vanished in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on a flight from Shanghai to Chicago. All of a sudden, my 5-year-old brain had grasped the concept of first names and last names, not just family names. So I became Ruoxi Yang. However, my parents decided to Americanize the pronunciation and started calling me Rosie. On my first night in America, I was lounging on my parents' ugly bronze couch when my father shoved a battered Chinese-American dictionary in front of my face. "Look, can you read that? It's rose, a type of beautiful flower." I understood the meaning, but not the significance of what my father was trying to convey to me. "That's going to be your new name. It's close to Ruoxi. Do you like it?" I had no say in my name change, but I don't think I really had anything to say. I went along my merry way and enrolled in kindergarten. Up until sophomore year, Rosie and Ruoxi Yang were one and the same because it was me. That summer, I applied for a work permit at my high school so I could work at the local pool. I had to bring in my social security card, which said Ruoxi Yang. I didn't think it was a big deal and had filled out Rosie Yang on the application like I had filled out every other form. The secretary who processed the work permit paperwork gave me a funny look and my world shifted. "What do you mean I couldn't be two names?" The secretary changed my school records to Ruoxi Rosie Yang with the Rosie in parentheses without consulting me. Again, I don't think I could have offered anything constructive in this interchange, and I felt comfortable with Ruoxi Rosie with the Rosie in parentheses. Along I went on my merry way again until I got to college. Here, there are no modified names. The University of Illinois only recognizes Ruoxi Yang. That's when my name started to bother me. After 18 years of being Rosie, who is the university telling me that I'm not? I'm only Ruoxi on paper, but I exist beyond paper. Physically, I am Rosie. I've decided I've had enough of pretending to be Ruoxi and having people mispronounce my name. This year, I have finally taken an active role in naming myself. With the help of the Student Legal Services Office, I am going to be Rosie Ruoxi Yang, because Ruoxi is still a small part of me.
The Other Me by Ian Williams.
It seems that in each of our lives there exists a person who annoys the living hell out of us. They might not seem all that annoying to others, but everything they do makes your stomach churn like you've eaten some bad sweet and sour pork the night before. They may be the most friendly and helpful person around, but to you they become an emotional trip mine, and each time they speak, you imagine tying them to the back of a semi and telling the driver to just keep going till he hits Wyoming. For me, that person is a neighbor of mine on my dorm floor, with whom I have the distinct pleasure, well, the coincidence, of sharing a name. For the first 2 years of my college experience, I've lived a few yards away from a bizarro version of myself, complete with a similar hairstyle and color, as well as a strange number of common interests, but with the unique ability to elicit a deep, unrelenting rage from the darkest corners of my soul. I'm often asked, "Which one are you again? Are you the one I always hear singing?" What kind of singing, I respond, already knowing their reply. "You know, the kind of off-pitch pop rock with mediocre guitar playing to accompany?" "Oh no, I'm the one who sings show tunes in the showers," an answer that usually ends the conversation. One of our other neighbors made a rather apt description of him, saying, quote, "He's enthusiastic, but he just doesn't know when to stop." I've often come home to find Other Me and an unfortunate fellow resident locked in conversation. Other Me sits there, eyes wide and mouth spewing forth words faster than a machine gun, usually talking about a film or television show that he's a fan of, while his unfortunate victim sits in stunned silence, unable to escape. Once I walked in on one such session that pushed my blood pressure to levels usually only seen in retail clerks on the day after Thanksgiving. That night I found other me and his victim sitting in front of his computer listening to music. Not just any music, but one of my favorite musicals. And you know who had decided to sing along? This act of musical theater evangelism hit me hard. Not only did he steal my name, now he stole my music. And that was when I realized exactly why I didn't like the other me. My whole life, I'd only known a handful of people with my name, and none of them were ever that much like me. On top of that, I was an only child, so I'd never had to deal with another person being so much like me and having people constantly compare me to him. So when I hit college and was confronted by my doppelganger, I just kind of snapped. It's like my subconscious immediately decided I would never like him or anything related to him. My irrational hatred of him came to a point last spring when I had to work with him and four other students to plan this year's freshman orientation for our floor. Every week he would come to our meetings with another idea for what we could do that, no matter how good it may have been, I hated. A floor soccer game? Please. Like international students, like soccer. An ice cream social? What are we in fourth grade? Free pizza for everyone? Well, that kid... Damn, he got me with that one.
Take a Seat by Allison Dinell.
One activity almost always occurs simultaneously with learning, and that is sitting. Few classes on this campus manage to teach students without first providing them chairs. The exceptions offer college students the opportunity to pull a muscle in class by utilizing bowling lanes or the ice arena, but the predominant learning environment at the University of Illinois is the lecture hall. While large lectures are a common part of the university experience, each lecture hall offers its own unique perks and torture devices. After accumulating 4 years of lecture hall expertise, I consider myself a seasoned sedentary learner and offer this handy review of popular lecture halls for fellow and future students. Noise 100. I have had the pleasure of enduring 4 courses in this torture chamber of education. In order to seat around 300 grumpy chemistry students, the architect ingeniously decided to sacrifice legroom, leaving it to students to find creative positions to avoid bruising their knees and going numb in the course of 50 minutes. The front row and aisles are extremely popular for this reason. Unfortunately, all the left-handed desks are situated in the aisles and are invariably filled by lanky righties. This leaves lefties like me to either adopt a contortionist pose or give up using the little fold-up desks altogether. Despite the discomfort, Noise 100 offers decent lighting and acoustics, so the only barrier to learning in this room is overcoming your physical suffering. If you have to take a class here, I recommend also taking up Buddhism, or arriving early enough to grab a good seat. Library 66. This lecture hall offers a special challenge to new students by being virtually impossible to find. Many students make the mistake of showing up to the library before the first day of class or an exam, with 5 minutes to spare and no previous knowledge of the room's location. A rat race ensues, with stressed students scurrying from one haphazardly taped sign with an arrow to the next. The paper arrows lead students through a labyrinth, past false doors and dark corners with exposed pipes, until the relieved students finally stumble upon a modern, comfortable lecture hall hidden in the bowels of the library. More savvy lecture-goers use shortcuts such as the elevator or the outdoor basement entrance. Once you find the lecture room, you can sit back and relax and soak up a wealth of knowledge from your cushioned chair. Follinger Auditorium. This behemoth room hosts all manner of introductory courses and electives with high student enrollment. Professors have the liberty of pacing the entire stage, and laser pointers are a must to highlight the important information presented on a projector screen the size of 4 elephants. The dim lighting of the interior makes it easy to find a cozy spot where you won't draw attention to yourself as you nod off. The decrepit desks are perhaps the worst drawback to attending class here, as they discourage note-taking and thus encourage power napping. Lincoln Hall Theater. Finally, I must take a moment to pay homage to my very first lecture room, the late, great Lincoln Hall Theater. Although indefinite renovation plans have retired this historic theater from its use as a classroom for upwards of 600 students, it holds a place in the hearts of many who have graced its creaky and occasionally broken seats. Its regal entrance up a flight of ornate marble steps and around the glowing bust of Lincoln belies the crumbling, musty auditorium within. My chief complaint with the room is the awkward spacing of the stairs, which are extremely short and wide. Climbing the stairs after submitting an exam turns into an awkward dance involving a combination of leaps, lunges, and rapid hops. Fortunately, the renovated theater will fit modern accessibility standards. Lincoln's bronze nose is currently sorely neglected from polishing for good luck as students pass his bust in front of the theater. Hopefully, Lincoln Hall will reopen soon and allow students to give the nose a good buffing before they take a seat and prepare to learn.
Looking for Nothing by Elena Stewie.
Looking, searching, seeking. Always the same quest, but pursuing a different reward every time. It is 10 o'clock p.m. I run my fingers through my tightly curled hair, loosening it into tousled waves. I examine my makeup, add a touch of lip gloss, an extra coat of mascara. Tradition dictates that I must try to appear attractive, but must not appear as if I am trying to be attractive. Although this is a quest of my own undertaking, its rules are not my own. My closet door opens to reveal a myriad of sequins and jewel tones, bright reds and turquoises. I choose a dashing, elegant violet satin top, although tonight is no grand premiere. This script has been acted out many times before. After a last spritz of enticing fragrance, I step out into the brisk night air. Wind tugs at my hair and whips about my bare arms. Shouts and laughter float toward me on the chilled breeze. I quicken my pace, check the time. I have an agenda to adhere to. Finally, as I round a corner, bright lights and raucous noises burst through the darkness. It is 11 o'clock p.m. I stride briskly down the line of chatting, stilettoed merrymakers and halt at the sight of friendly faces near the front. I smile, wave, and step over the velvet rope. I flash my ID to the bouncer with practiced ease and saunter over to the bored-looking 20-something working the cash register. My first test of the evening. I smile, tilt my head, and make eye contact as I lean towards him and ask how much for cover. He starts slightly, flickers his eyes over me, and shakes his head. No cover for you. I smile ingratiatingly and step inside. The air is warm now, pulsing with music and jostling people. My friends and I snake our way through the crowd to a table overlooking the dance floor. We sit down and begin exchanging clever jokes and tales of quests gone by. I smile and laugh appropriately, all the while keeping my thoughts and eyes on the crowd below us. Finally, I zero in on a target. I excuse myself to the restroom. As I push through drunken partygoers, I deliberately angle my path to brush past a tall, attractive male, with dark hair and dark eyes. He turns slightly, meeting my glance. I give him a shy smile and lower my eyes quickly, almost embarrassed, or so it seems. It is midnight. Half an hour later, the tall, attractive male sidles up to me at our table. "Hey, how's it going? Can I get you a drink?" he asks me. We exchange introductions. "I recognized you from class," he says. Inwardly, I roll my eyes. He's a business major. I'm a biology major. I have never seen him before in my life. "Yeah, you do look really familiar," I say earnestly, and touch his arm unnecessarily. He pulls me over to his group of friends to introduce me, mispronouncing my name. The throbbing music filling our ears, we enthusiastically engage in superficial conversation about our activities, hometowns, and musical interests. I pretend to enjoy country music and lie about being a Cubs fan. I'm on autopilot now, the details of the conversation rushing by me like the bustling crowd. Was his name Steve, or was it Brad? Where did he live again? Why am I here? It is 2 o'clock a.m. The sharp wind cuts around me. I wrap my arms around myself and tilt my head down as I navigate the silent streets back to my apartment. Alone. Another night, another quest. And the only remaining proof of my endeavor is a 10-digit number programmed into my cell phone, titled Mike from Brothers.
The Fawn of Allen Hall by Tara McGovern.
On the first Saturday of the semester, the gorgeous weather drags me outside by my ankles. I perch with my laptop balanced on my knees at the top of a hill overlooking the retention pond near my dorm. The colors of the trees and sky are exploding with sunlight, and the breeze tugs my dress against my legs. Indistinguishable snatches of pop music float across the pond from some event in Illini Grove, overlapping with the soothing splatter of the fountain. A tall, gangly young man trots out of the trees to my left, carrying a bundle of brightly colored cloth. He's wearing only an earthy brown pair of shorts, his fringe of honey brown hair bouncing with his swaying gait. I recognize him as Nick, registered hypnotist, president of the Hygge Club, expert in all things Egyptian, and first-floor resident advisor. Nick is somewhat of a celebrity in Allen Hall, embodying the hippie dementia that makes Allen residents famous. For example, when we discovered last night's torrential downpour, we all rushed outside, fully clothed, and danced in the rain. Nick took it a step further, stripping down to his shorts and prancing around, improvising tunes on his Egyptian flute. I watch Nick gamble down the hill and lay down a rich golden crimson cloth, position his luxurious golden hookah, and sit cross-legged beside the pond playing on his flute. The music sways and dips in sync with the brush of the wind past the trees and the quiet rush of the fountain, even blending with a throb from Illini Grove. Suddenly it strikes me that Nick resembles a faun, a goat-legged mythical creature who hypnotizes with flutes and dances in forests. Nick notices me looking at him, and he waves solemnly, offering me a puff on the hookah. I smile awkwardly and shake my head. He repeats the gesture with a flute, and I shake my head again. The longer I sit here, listening to Nick's enchanting music and smelling Nick's delicious hookah, the less I feel like studying. My computer screen is so glossy that I see my reflection more clearly than the faint text beneath. I look like I could be sitting next to Nick, with my exotic chandelier earrings, wispy red scarf, and Middle Eastern-inspired sundress. I feel like I've fallen into the Chronicles of Narnia, not through a wardrobe, but through the magic mirror of my computer screen. This laptop is like that lamppost in the deep Narnian woods, the only link between me and the outside world. I could just leave it here, chuck it in the pond, bury it in the bushes, and go sit beside Nick, Mr. Tumnus, and be hypnotized by fawn flutes and hookah smoke and be queen of Narnia or Egypt or whatever, and never come back. But I won't do that. I know I won't. As tempting and insane and beautiful my imagination is, I will never follow it. That's the line between creativity and insanity, I think. The sane will never let it go, never throw their laptops in the water, never be fully hypnotized. I've only been here a week, but that line is becoming thinner and thinner and blurrier and blurrier. I wonder how long I'll last.
Thank you.
Computing the Future by Dave Karechin.
There's a strange-looking student sitting outside the entrance to the Granger Engineering Library. He has shimmering bronze skin, and his brown hair is neatly parted to the right. He wears a white collared shirt beneath his blue varsity jacket, an Illinois emblem next to the left breast pocket. He has white slacks, tan dress socks, and brown loafers. His legs are crossed, right over left, and he pores over an open book. He sits perfectly still, never turning the page, completely absorbed. On occasion, students pace in front of him and smoke cigarettes, or they sit next to him along the stone side of the building and open a textbook or talk on a cell phone. I wonder where he came from, how long he's been there, what book he could be so engrossed in. I decide to find out. The library, a massive red brick building with square windows and a blue roof, towers over the grasses as I stroll across the Bardeen Quad. The statue is there by the library doors, glistening with raindrops, his shiny bronze nose in his book. Glancing around, I take a seat to the statue's left. I tentatively scoot closer and peer over his shoulder to see what he's reading. After a few minutes, I get up and enter the library. I explain to a girl behind the checkout desk that I am curious about the statue outside and that I am wondering if she knows anything about it. "His name is Kenny," she mumbles. She tilts her head toward the reference desk. They might know more about him. With an awkward chuckle, I thank her and walk over to the reference desk. The two receptionists make a quick call on the desk phone, and a lady arrives, introducing herself as the assistant engineering librarian. She explains that the statue's formal name is Computing a Future, and it was sculpted by John Seward Johnson, Jr. in 1994. The sculpture is cast in wax and overlaid with bronze, and it requires renovation every 2 years. The book in the statue's hands is a report by the National Research Council in 1992 proposing changes to education to ensure the future viability of computer science and engineering. The library staff endearingly calls him Kenny, after Ken the Barbie doll, the lady informs me, but many of the engineering students give him a different name, Granger Bob. The lady explains that Kenny has been through a lot. He wore women's lingerie on Valentine's Day, held an umbrella when it rained, and sported an Illinois baseball cap during finals week. She mentions that there is even a Facebook page devoted to him. I thank her for her time, but before I go, I check out a copy of Kenny's book, a paperback with the words Computing the Future in bright red letters on the blue cover. Resuming my seat next to Kenny, I cross my legs right over left and open my book to the page he is reading. On the left-hand page, a circular diagram depicts computer science and engineering in the center, branching out to other disciplines, including art, humanities, business, and medicine. As I consider how important computers are in our daily lives today, I find it funny that the future viability of computer science and engineering was ever in question. I turn and study the pensive figure next to me. When Kenny first took his seat outside of Granger, he could scarcely imagine the changes a mere decade would bring, an age dominated by laptops and the internet, the integration of computers into every aspect of modern life. He meditates by the doors, awaiting a future that has already come to pass. And yet he's stuck in time. He should be reading the book from a laptop screen. As I watch Kenny stare eagerly into the open page, I realize that here, as well as on many other college campuses across the world, the future is being shaped by starry-eyed students hard at work, making visions into reality. With a strong sense of pride, I stuff the book into my backpack, say goodbye, and head back across the quad.
Opening a Door by Sarah Peters.
Are you busy? When I shook my head, Jim stepped in gingerly, like he was afraid I'd bite him if he crossed the threshold. Awkwardly, he leaned against the sparse dorm room wall. He wore an unmemorable t-shirt and those same khaki shorts that every college boy owns. Jim had a mop of blonde hair and pale skin that always seemed to be flushed. I heard you had this open door hour, thought I should stop by. I smiled nervously. It was my first year as a resident assistant, and I naively thought that open door hour was a good way to build relationships. I mean, get my residents to like me. I put up cute flyers around the floor promising board games and good conversation for anyone who came to my room between 10 and 11 on Wednesday nights. None of the girls showed up. I hadn't yet learned that it's extremely difficult to get college students to do just about anything, unless, of course, you offer them free food. I wasn't really sure why Jim wanted to come visit me. He was in his third year as an RA on my hall staff. He was the coworker who I knew least well. Actually, I could only think of one conversation we'd ever had. It was one of the first days of RA training. I told him about my summer internship in Washington, D.C., and he told me that he'd almost done an internship in Russia. I thought an American interning in Russia was kind of absurd, but I didn't say anything about it. It fell through, he said. My dad thought it was kind of shady. I laughed. Anyway, I figured that the awkwardness of the situation at hand was due to the fact that we didn't know each other very well. The list of things I knew about Jim was limited to 1, he likes video games, and 2, he's a grad student in accounting. We were still at the what kind of music do you like, or do you have any siblings, stage of our friendship. What I thought would be a quick 5-minute conversation turned into an hour. We discussed movies and TV shows and books and just whatever we could think to talk about. I learned that he was really into literature and that he enjoyed writing. Why are you a business major then? I asked. Why not English or something? Well, I figure I can write a book while I spend a few years in a boring job, you know, just to make enough to support myself and anyone I pick up along the way. I laughed hysterically. That's romance right there, he added. Jim's sarcasm, his aloofness, it reminded me of myself. We had more in common than I thought. Maybe we would be friends after all. There was a lull in the conversation, and a question I'd really wanted to ask popped into my head. Well, I guess it wasn't really just a question. It was opening a whole can of worms. I knew that one of the RAs from last year, Stephen, had committed suicide. I wanted to know the whole story, so I tactlessly blurted out the only thing I knew. So, Jake came here after the whole suicide thing? Jake was another RA who had come to take the place of the one who died. I thought that maybe Jake might have some emotional connection to what had happened, so I'd always been too afraid to ask him about it. I thought that Jim, because of his impersonal manner, would be able to give me an objective account. I immediately realized that it seemed wrong when I saw the pained expression on his face. Yes, he replied. Shit, I wanted to hit rewind. It was really hard for us. Stephen was my best friend on the staff. I was the one his dad called. I spent a lot of time last year dealing with it. He looked away. I was sorry I had asked. I was sorry I had referred to his best friend's death as the suicide thing. But I was relieved to see Jim let down his guard, to see an emotional human being, if only for a moment.
Hair, by Daniel Cohen.
Pounding feet approached my room as two heated voices continued their argument. I sighed, taking one last look at the blank computer screen in front of me, and turned in time to see them burst through my door. The pair of them made an odd couple. One was short, with a chip on his shoulder. The other was tall, but perpetually slouching. Both their heads freshly cut, their voices reached a crescendo as they stopped right in front of me. "Whose hair is shorter?" they demanded. I took a moment to examine the situation. Adam, the short one, seemed ready for a fight. He was breathing heavily and giving me the wide eyes and raised eyebrows that warned of an impending argument. Jordan, the tall, slouching one, stayed back, reserved. Each of them paused expectantly, confident that my answer would validate their opinion. I weighed my options, deciding which opponent would be easier to placate. Unfortunately, my brief hesitation provoked them both into upping the ante. They bent their heads towards me, two warriors being knighted before a king. Touch our hair. No second option was given. I am not a fan of hair. Don't get me wrong. As long as it stays on people's heads and out of my way, I have no problem with it. But hair is a sneaky way of intruding onto unwelcome territory, be it my Cold Stone ice cream last week, or all over the back of my shirt after my most recent haircut. Usually I catch hair red-handed and simply ask for a new ice cream or change my shirt. This time, however, hair was abandoning stealth and staging a full-out frontal assault on my senses. I nervously looked at the two heads in question. Jordan's hair was a wavy brown ocean. It had clearly just been cut, but the shortness of the hair did nothing to fix the entangled thickness. I shuddered to think of all the hidden loose strands of hair that surely must be taking refuge on top of his head, having eluded the common fate of falling to the floor in the barbershop and being swept up by a college kid. Visions flashed before my eyes of my naked, civilized pink hand slipping carelessly into Jordan's hair forest, only to emerge a hairy beast. I forced back down the lump crawling up my throat and turned to weigh Jordan's adversary. Adam's hair was much less intimidating. Straight, buzz-cut, and brown, it almost welcomed my touch. There were no surprises here. I tried to use Adam's head as an escape from the hairy situation. Adam's is clearly shorter. I turned back to my computer, hoping they would both just go away. Of course, this only stirred up a loud commotion of protests. I took a deep breath and turned back to face them, my face a steely mask of determination, willing them to leave. You have to touch our hair. It's the only way you'll know. My resolve weakened. But it's clearly, just touch our hair! There was no escape now. Stifling a shudder, I plunged both my pink, naked hands into their freshly cut heads of hair. As expected, my left hand completely disappeared into Jordan's hair forest, but it felt oddly comforting, like wearing a woolly mitten. My right hand rested on top of Adam's brittle head, and I noticed that the prickly sensation was oddly pleasant. I began rubbing his head like it was a magic lamp. This ridiculous scene would not be complete without an unassuming visitor to happen across the spectacle. As I raised my eyes to the wide-open doorway, I saw Jordan's girlfriend standing there, her brow creased in puzzled surprise. What are you guys doing? The question hung in the air, an elephant in the room. She looked mildly afraid. I yanked back my hands, noting with some relief that my left hand remained hairless, and quietly muttered, Adam's is shorter, before turning back to the computer. Both of them slowly stood, a look of understanding dawning on their faces, and they turned to walk out of the room.
Files of Team Leader McBucket by Gretchen Broman.
11:48 a.m. Waffles, soggy buns, and I leave Sandella's with exactly 1 hour to accomplish our mission. Agenda Item A. To locate item officially known as cash, which we believe is being held at the top of the parking garage next to Allen Hall. Secret Agenda Item B. Refer to soggy buns only as soggy buns until he realizes that it's the codename Waffles and I have chosen for him. 11:50 a.m. Huddled over Soggy Bun's iPhone, we examine the target, carefully noting the GPS coordinates, cardinal directions, and distance to the destination. As team leader, I command the unit to head out. I hold the phone like a compass as we begin our march. We ruefully regret not having acquired those walkie-talkies we saw at Menards and our inabilities to army crawl long distances. Soggy Bun's hums the James Bond theme song. 11:58 a.m. As we emerge from the shade of a towering white oak and move in the direction of the campus recreation facility, I look down at the coordinates on the iPhone and, momentarily discombobulated, lose our position. We huddle up and regroup. Waffles takes the initiative, and by rotating the map a quarter turn, she reorients the unit and sets us back on track. I lose iPhone privileges. 12:01 p.m. Across the street, the parking garage looms high against the clear blue sky. The wind whips at our hair and tugs at our jackets, and the bright sunlight glares off parked cars that face us like rows of sentries. Through our dark shades, we eye the garage up and down, each of us assessing the entrances, exits, and weak spots of the enemy. We slowly traverse the street, three abreast. 12:04 p.m. Before infiltration, we huddle up to review the intel. Clue number one, the GPS coordinates obtained from the geocaching website. Using the iPhone, Soggy Buns confirms we are headed in the correct direction. Clue number two, the website tells us to go forth and park. While there are other parking lots in the area, we feel the cache must be in the parking garage based on Clue number three. The cache is entitled, The One That Might Give You a Workout. We We believe the cache is located at the top of the garage. 12:08 p.m. We storm the garage at a sprint. As we bound up the stairs, we take care to yell, "Oh, this is such a workout," and "I feel the burn." By the time we reach the sixth and final floor, we are no longer sprinting, and we do feel the burn. 12:15 p.m. We burst onto the rooftop, certain the end of our quest is within grasp. iPhone outstretched, Soggy Buns runs a few feet and then turns in haphazard circles. Waffles and I perform a quick sweep of the mostly barren concrete, noting the two distantly parked lone cars. From this vantage point, campus is a whole different world, a jungle of slated, tar-pitched roofs and small attic windows framed by tufts of colorful treetops and crystal-clear skies. In the distance, we can make out the weather vane on the top of the Union and the aged Altgeld bell tower. Turning back to our goal, we huddle around Soggy Buns and the GPS, which tells us we are 72 feet from the cache. We begin to pace, counting our steps aloud, excitement building with each stride. 1, 2, 3, but the iPhone changes its mind, and suddenly we are 36 feet away. 2 feet later, we are 9 feet away. 12:18 p.m. We have fanned out. Waffles is sweeping to the north, Soggy Buns to the southwest, and I have taken the east side. We have lost faith in our equipment, since the closest the iPhone gets us is 3 feet from the cache. We are on our own, trusting our guts and instincts. 12:24 p.m. What at first seemed like such a concrete location, the parking garage, is now a vast and unconquerable beast. After scouring our respective corners, we return, dismayed, to the first corner the GPS indicated. On hands and knees, Soggy Buns looks up a drainage pipe, while Waffles leans over the side, searching for a ledge or a hidden crevice. Having no luck, we decide to fan out again. 12:28 p.m. Discouraged and empty-handed, we reassess the facts. Fact number one, the parking garage is huge, but without many secure hiding locations. We feel that we should be able to see anything unusual, such as a hidden treasure box. Fact number two, we are not exactly sure what we are looking for. A Tupperware container, wooden box, little baggie? Fact number three, the coordinates are only longitude and latitude, without a Z component. We initially ran to the top floor because of the workout aspect of the clue, but what if the treasure is on a different floor? 12:29 p.m. While analyzing the clues, Soggy Buns has a flash of brilliance. Go forth and park must mean the fourth floor. Enthusiasm for the quest reignited, we race back to the stairwell and down to the fourth floor. 12:35 p.m. We search up and around pipes, between crevices, in sewage drains, and along ledges, but with no luck. Deciding we read too much into the go forth clue, we return to the top floor. 12:40 p.m. Another round of searching turns up no treasure. Disheartened and desperate, we begin to blame the previous cache questers, since they must have moved the box. Next, we blame the janitorial staff for throwing it away, and then decide an animal must have taken it. The problem is clearly not within our own elite, three-person unit. 12:43 p.m. Soggy Buns must leave for work, and Waffles and I have class at 1. Hope all but gone, we half-heartedly check every floor on our way down. 12:49 p.m. Waffles and I are on the ground floor, barely looking. But we have not admitted defeat. Before parting ways, we decided to return this weekend, this time more prepared. So if you see two ninjas with walkie-talkies and a tom-tom prowling the parking garage next to Allen Hall, do not be alarmed. We just haven't given up the quest.
Repeat by Jenna Holland.
Dear Debtor, found you. While I am very impressed with your adventurous spirit and your ability to move across state lines each and every billing period, I would appreciate it if you would please leave a forwarding address next time. I almost didn't find you this month, and I know you would be devastated if you failed to receive this friendly little reminder from your favorite collector. You may not remember, as it is probable that your years here passed in a haze of drunken frat parties, unfortunate one-night stands, and caffeine highs followed by cafeteria-induced food comas, but you were, in fact, a student at our university. The real reason for your stay on our lovely campus was to attend classes, frequent the library, and gain experience for the real world. Even if you failed to accomplish these things, which is likely given your current employment in the food service industry, we would still like you to pay us for them. In fact, we insist. If you don't pay your outstanding balance, we will continue to stalk you by monitoring your movements, calling you at home, and commandeering your state tax refunds while holding your transcript hostage. I would also like to inform you that in the time it has taken us to hunt you down, your bill has increased due to late payment charges, collection fees, and as a general penalty for being a delinquent. These additional fees have now doubled your account balance. Unfortunately, most of your infrequent payments up to this point have not even covered these monthly late charges, and your debt continues to compound. If you do not call me by the end of the week, my boss will force me to send you to a collection agency. You will not like this. You will be harassed by a terrifying anonymous entity that will leave threatening messages on your answering machine and wreak havoc on your credit score. However, if you just send me one little check, I promise to be gentle. I look forward to your call. Have a nice day.